Blog Talk Radio.
Options Show with Richard Talk to Me Guy and Sherry Edwards. Good morning, Sherry. How are you?
Good morning, Richard. In a second or two, I'll tell you how stupid I am to tell you how I am. But it all fits in with the show. So this is Sound Health Options, where we hope to bring you information and ideas to make your life a little fuller and better and in support of self-health. So we're sponsored by the Sound Health Institute of Bioacoustic Biology in Albany, Ohio. We just had an exciting two-day free course, two-day technician course about allergies. And that fits so well into our guest today. And she's going to talk about allergies and medications and how people get allergies and how they get out of allergies. So it's going to be a splendiferous show.
That's really exciting about, you know, for people to have the ability. One of the things I love about your work is that it's giving people, and this is, I know, a word that our guest today, Gwen Olson, uses quite a bit, is about it being empowered or empowerment. And it really does, once you start seeing and using some of even just the Nano Voice, the good old Nano Voice, the free, amazing software. Remember, people, I don't work for Sherry. I'm really saying this because I mean it. Once you start actually, you know, seeing one of these programs work, like in the allergy testing, and you look at your vocal print run through the software, and you get this amazing report saying, oh, you might have, you know, be inclined to grasses. You might be inclined to, you know, things that you never thought of. You might be allergic to cats, but you don't have a cat. But there's a cat neighborhood, and you wonder why you sneeze. Or, I mean, it's just really, it gives you amazing information to then, with that, have the choice to then begin to figure out how to, you know, be aware of it and remove those things or reduce those things or reduce the exposure. It's great stuff. Sherry does.
We should tell people that at the Institute, we stick a microphone in front of someone's face and we get a 30-second sample of their voice, and we can look at the sour notes in their voice, just like the sour notes in a song, and come up with what's going on. Now I'm going to tell you about my stupidity. Most of you know that I recently fell off a second-story balcony and ended up in the hospital in rehab for well over a month. And I got used to them coming in and jabbing me with meds and do this, because if you don't go along with what they do, then your insurance won't pay. And I don't know if people know that as a rule or if they were just threatening me. But anyway, I got into this mode of listening to the doctor. And for the past, four or five days, I have not been able to sleep. I just lay there awake with my mind racing, and I keep a little tablet there. These are all the things I have to do, and it becomes pages and pages. Here's an idea for an article, and there it goes. So last week, I went to the doctor as my checkup for my broken back, and they said, any other problem? I said, well, I'm having trouble sleeping. So they prescribed a medication, and dummy took it, and it's called trazodone, something or the other. And I woke up the next morning, and my eyes were swollen shut and puffy. And I thought, well, I'll tell the doctor that on Monday, because that certainly didn't work. And I started looking it up, and it was for depression. I didn't tell him anything about depression. I'm not depressed, but that's what they gave me. And so it was about 6 this morning. I still hadn't gone to sleep yet. And I decided, Sherry, you are so stupid. go do your own vocal prints. And I did, and it was so obvious. Magnesium was missing out of my voice big time. And I just took a handful of powdered magnesium and started licking it like one of those little candy things that you lick. And within probably less than 10 minutes, I was in bed asleep. Now, that's the kind of wonderful things that we do when we look at these voices. You're laughing at me, Richard.
Well, I am, because I've had my same, you know, people listen to us and think, boy, they know a lot of stuff. But it doesn't mean we always remember first line to actually do those things to ourselves. And that's why I'm laughing with you, because I've had those same kind of things where it's, you know, I have a lot of what I would call head noise, you know, just stuff going on in my brain, thinking about things, formulations, you know, trying to figure something out. And so I take some, you know, herbal teas before I go to bed, skullcap, passion flower, really great, you know, calming agents without, you know, that don't leave you inflamed and weirded out and imbalanced. And so I have, but so that's why I'm laughing. It's like I'll be stewing and flopping around, and then I'll suddenly go, oh, just have some tea, for God's sakes. And then it's like, oh, I go to sleep, I'm fine. But we forget. I don't know. There's a where that slip is where it's we forget these things.
I think part of mine was I had been in that dependency mode, and also the medication just ruined my eyesight. It was real fuzzy. It was really hard to read or anything. So, but that's my excuse. I would like everybody to come to Bioacoustics first, you know, take your vocal print, take your blood pressure, take your temperature kind of thing. But sometimes I forget how powerful this is, and I think it's just because it came from me. Sometimes I don't trust it all that well. And when we talk about trust and our health, so many things going on. I just read an article about the Rochester General Hospital and how they are forcing medications on children, psychiatric medications, ADHD medications. And so one of the things that I want to say before we go to our guest is I have done a vocal profile on Gwen Olson, who wrote Confessions of a Prescription Drug Pusher. And she was with these guys for years and years and was very rich because of it. And then she got in touch with Jeff Hayes, or he with her, I don't know. And they had a film put together. She's one of the featured speakers, called Doctored. And by the way, we've made arrangements with Jeff Hayes for all of you to be able to preview that film. And it's on our front page, soundhealthoptions.com. Front left top, you can preview that, and you can send the link to your millions of friends and family and have them preview the link. Because in that film, Gwen Olson talks about her experience of being a drug rep. I think it's for GlaxoSmithKline. I think that's who she was working for. And how she became so good at her job that they had her training people. And in some of the training materials, she just went internally ballistic about what she was involved in and what she was pushing doctors to do. And we've done this vocal profile, and it's on our site. You can look at the entire transcript of it. And here's what one of the places she said, and then we'll listen to what she has to say, because it's so powerful. She's talking about going to see doctors and telling them about getting these kids on meds as soon as possible, as in vaccines, even the day of birth. So here's her words. It becomes an add-on business technique to sell more drugs and to have lifelong customers. All kids have insurance. They're either covered by private insurance or Medicaid, so therefore you have a guaranteed reimbursement in terms of every refill. Even if the parents are responsible, they still make their kids refill their prescriptions because that's what the doctor said. So this is really just a marketing ploy to get our children on drugs because they have recognized that not only are all of them covered by the insurance, but they are lifelong customers if you can get them on drugs at an early age. How does that make you feel, Richard?
Slightly nauseous.
Well, one of the,
Go ahead.
One of the things we know about vaccines, and there's this fight right now going on, and there's a lot of articles. One little kid just died after having five shots at once, died within hours. It's all over the news. It's all over the internet. So people are arguing. You have to get a herd mentality, says that Kelly lady on Fox News, who has a lot of pharmacy commercials on her show. You have to be a herd mentality. You have to give up your child so the herd can be better. You know, crap. If it's your child, it isn't. So she wouldn't be so blasé about it. But they keep saying, you know, there's no problem with vaccines. Everybody should have them. Yet we have a vaccine compensation injury program that has given out, after they go through court, well, quasi-court, given out billions of dollars in damages. Now, they can't have it both ways. We have to have this. You have to get shots, and it's becoming mandatory in lots of states. And like this New York hospital, they can give you the shots, and if your parents don't like it, your parents go to jail for neglect or child abuse. They can't have it. Yes, we're paying out billions of dollars for damages, but they don't damage anybody. And that's one of the things that Gwen is trying to bring to the forefront with her book, Prescriptions from a Drug Pusher. Astounding information, and we just barely scratched the surface with her.
Absolutely. I want to throw in one other thing that is related to this. It doesn't involve Gwen directly. However, it is in the field of what she's talking about in terms of toxicity and environment and diet and everything. There's a great short video from our friends at Next World TV, the BB Farmer Group, and the video is titled, Where is All the Testosterone Going? And it's talking about the fact that testosterone levels are down in men 20%. Plus. I would suspect that it's higher. And in that video, the person speaking, whose name I can't remember right now, and I'll put this link in the chat, and I'll put it in the show notes. It's a short 2-minute piece where the person's just talking about all the things that are affecting testosterone levels in our environment. And you might think, well, you know, okay, that's, what's that mean? Well, it's partially what it means is that we have a combination of high loads of what are referred to as estrogen mimickers, which means that it acts in the male body in one way. It adds more estrogen into the males, sort of counterbalancing testosterone levels. So sperm counts are down, men are becoming more feminized. And the other side of that in women is that it means that this could be part of the reason why girls are having their menses earlier in their lives, becoming, you know, breastier and younger and more, you know, I'll just say estrogenized at an earlier age. Is it's the pollution, you know, it's a combination of the pollution, the diet, the totality of the exposure and the environment is gnarly. And part of that is that a lot of these water or fat-soluble pharmaceuticals that are taken then get excreted, particularly the ones that are water-soluble, into our water table. And yes, it gets purified, and yes, it gets cleaned, and yes, it gets theoretically sanitized. However, a lot of that bleeds through because nobody's testing for it. We're testing for, you know, pathogens, and we're looking for bugs, but we're not really looking for hormones and pharmaceuticals. And so it's a great video just talking about that. I think it's a really... You know, this fits right into the category of what Gwen's part of her world was and what it now has become. So it's just amazing to me. Do you have any other announcements, Sherry, or shall I open up Gwen?
I have lots of other announcements, but people can go to soundhelpoptions.com and look at all of our free classes and free softwares that we are offering. And there is a big professional class coming up on the 21st, and we are going to do a drawing for matching scholarships. And we're even thinking about doing one for giving away a totally free class. We don't know if we can get permission from our board yet, but we're thinking about that because we think allergies are so important, and a lot of them are being created, or at least it looks that way, by these vaccines and medications. So we'd love it if people could join us, soundhealthoptions.com, classes, there's free films, free classes, free videos there. We would like everyone to be able to create a bioacoustic center in their community, and we've given people enough software and education to do that. We want to jump on
that. I cannot recommend that highly enough to everybody. To be able to take those classes and to get it for free if possible is, like, stunningly great.
Yeah, because we're looking at classes. Well, the one we just did for free, that cost $1,200. But everybody got in for free on that one. We want to join Gwen in her desire to make a difference and to get Big Brother and Big Pharma out of our lives until we decide we need them, not the other way around.
Boy, howdy. Okay. Gwen Olson is the author of the award-winning book Confessions of an RX Drug Pusher. A 15-year veteran pharmaceutical rep, Gwen worked for McNeil Pharmaceutical, Syntex Labs, Bristol Myers Squibb, and others. She was a hospital rep and specialist rep for the majority of her career selling prescription drugs to doctors. Gwen joins us to share her unique insider's perspective of the current U.S. drug problem. She gives details about her awakening process that began with the realization that the information she was disseminating to doctors was extremely skewed, and later was ignited through a family member's heartbreaking journey of becoming a mental health patient. Gwen explains her role as a marketing tool for pharma, where successful drug sales are calculated through doctor profiling and often encouraged with extravagant perks to prescribing doctors. We discuss the corruption and money-making interests of the rapidly expanding $300 billion global pharmaceutical market, and Gwen breaks down the greatly slanted process of the FDA drug approval. When we first met you, I put that in large air quotes, we saw you after we'd interviewed Jeff Hayes in his film Doctored. Did you have any thought, you know, was there any time during your 15-year career in the drug industry that you'd be where you are today? I mean, was there any inkling, and was there an aha moment, or like, what am I doing here? Did you want to have another life, or did you think you'd have this, like, completely other life? Was there any of that in there?
That's an excellent question, and to be completely honest, no, I didn't. I never anticipated that I would be a whistleblower, even when I chose to leave the pharmaceutical industry. I was basically just glad to get out of the industry with my life, because I was so unhealthy and I had been such a proponent of my own philosophies and taking drugs out of the trunks of my car and out of the trunks of other sales representatives and the things that doctors gave me. And I was the quick fix queen at that point. And I truly was indoctrinated and believed in what I was doing and thought that I was benefiting mankind initially. But what happened was I had a number of aha moments. And as I matured in the industry and started doing my own due diligence and research and started having one experience after another where I started seeing, you know, the disinformation and misinformation campaigns that I was being required to deliver on the front lines to the providers, then I started having a series of aha moments that showed me how compartmentalized that the pharmaceutical industry was, where the right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing, and the information that I was given was basically marketing information, and I was being tasked with the responsibility of profiling providers, you know, finding out what their personality types were and personal information about their affiliations and likes and dislikes and the churches they went to, the groups they were associated with, who their, you know, children and wives were, and reporting all of this information back to the company so that it was more easy to profile them and manipulate their prescribing habits, because that in and of itself was a big eye-opener. But, you know, I had a number of incidences where I saw where I had personally contributed to someone's death or to someone's harm because I had encouraged a provider to do something that was against his better judgment, and because they liked me and I was able to influence these individuals, and they had gone ahead and done something that they wouldn't probably have done had they not been, you know, influenced by me. And so it was a lot of things together. It took a long period of time, and not only was it those things, it was the fact that the companies themselves get you into a kind of debt situation to where that, you know, you're encouraged to buy the biggest house and drive new modeled vehicles and have all designer clothing and sunglasses and whatever and all of that sort of thing and stock portfolios and this and that, so that when you finally do come to the point where you're disgusted or feel that you're being asked to do something out of integrity, that you really have nowhere to go, because they choose people that don't have scientific backgrounds. They, you know, a lot of times they're looking for people that just have gregarious outgoing personalities that are attractive, that can get past the receptionist desk and into the doctor's office and that sort of thing. So I really didn't have the skill set with a language degree and a certification in Latin American studies to go out and get the high-paying dollar job like I had in the pharmaceutical industry with, you know, an expense account and a company car and all this and that. So I was kind of trapped for several years. I went to part-time and then tried to weed myself off of, you know, out of the industry in that manner, until I finally was just so ill, seriously was so ill, that I could not work any longer. And that's when I finally bailed and just said, you know, I'll never look back and I'll never go back. But I never, ever dreamed that I would be in the position that I'm currently in, where I would write a book, where I would testify before Congress and the FDA and be featured in all these documentaries and do all of this media and everything, because that just wasn't my cup of tea. It wasn't anything that I aspired for. I never wanted to be famous or infamous, either one. And I never really wanted to share my personal life and all the skeletons in my closet with everyone. But when I wrote my book, I recognized that the thing that the pharmaceutical industry would do to try to discredit me would be they would try to dig up any dirt that they could on me and present that. So I thought, you know what, I'm just going to put it all in a book and, you know, see what happens. And so that basically I started, my book started as an email after my niece, who was 20 years old, and she was attending Indiana University. She was a pre-med student. She was in a car accident, and she got addicted to hydrocodone, which is an opiate analgesic. And while she was trying to study for some exams, she was going to pull an all-nighter with some friends, and she had sedative side effects so severely from her drugs that she went to a local health food store and purchased a stimulant, ephedra, and she took it concomitantly with her other drugs, and she had a manic psychotic break. And she ended up in an emergency room, and she was diagnosed as being bipolar and put on a cocktail of various pharmaceuticals. And that started her journey on, you know, the road to being a permanent mental patient. So she had to drop out of school, and she was barely able to support herself, and she ended up coming to live with me in Texas at one point. And that's where I started to realize that she was having the same symptoms and was going through the exact same experience that I had had several years, maybe a decade prior to that, when I started trying to take antidepressants during a divorce. And at the time that I went through my experience, there wasn't that body of information that's currently out there. You can't get on the internet and go anywhere now, but you can't find, you know, information about the dangerous side effects of suicidal ideation, homicidal ideation, you know, agitation, aggression, all of that stuff that now we know are common, actually commonplace with the users of these particular categories of drugs. And so I had just kind of walked away from that experience just befuddled as to, you know, what had actually happened to me, and had gone into natural health and healing, trying to seek my own personal healing. And that became my area of interest, and therefore that was when I transitioned. That's what I went into and started working for Nature's Way first as a regional manager, and then I went to Gaia Herbs. So I got a good experience, a secondary experience then in herbal healing and homeopathy and vitamins and minerals and all of that. So it was really a well-rounded education. But then at some point, you know, after this happened to my niece, I felt, well, I need to explain to my family members and our loved ones what actually happened to her. I didn't want her to be labeled as mentally ill and for her, you know, memory to be sullied by that. And so that's why I sat down and started writing an email to my family members, which then turned into a chapter, which then turned into a book, which now has turned into a 10-year mission. So that's a long, long explanation to that question. But no, I had never intended to do that.
Right. We've come full circle to no, I didn't expect the spotlight to be on me like this. Not so much. I want to back up for a moment and ask the question. You've already stated it, but I want to be really clear for the audience. Are there any prerequisites to being a pharmaceutical rep in terms of education, or is it really more about looking the part, you know, everything that you talked about, living the life, doing the thing, being attractive, looking nice in a suit? Is it really more about, in terms of prerequisites, is it more about being a model in a certain sense than being an educated person in something?
Well, I do believe that they require a college education, but beyond that, no. No, it is more about
being...
It is much more about being a person that is easily, that can be easily trained, that has a gregarious, as I said, gregarious outgoing personality that can influence other people, and that is attractive. And so basically that, you know, I was a former beauty queen. I've moved beyond my day in the limelight in that regard, but, you know, that was something that I believe probably got my foot in the door, and God help them once I got my foot through it.
Right. And so you're really, I mean, you are in true sense, you're really a marketing rep for a product, and yet there's so much. I was in a healthcare facility for a year because I had 30 hours of surgeries. So over several, you know, long period of time, surgery after surgery. And so I watched the game, you know, and I put that in big air quotes. And really, I mean, it's amazing how much information you could watch a drug rep give a doctor, and yet you're not, you know, it's not like you're, and I'm not picking on you, I'm just saying in general in the industry, it's not like you're a pharmaceutical, I mean, it's not like you're a pharmacist or a chemist or a bio something or a, I mean, you're really a marketing rep who learns this amazing amount of information, or in your case, learn this amazing amount of information because you wanted to know what the heck you were doing. I mean, it's really your marketing rep.
That's
in the world.
Absolutely correct. And that
That's
was
amazing.
Again, one of the things that I had a conflict about, because I was dependent solely on the marketing department to give me, and my management team to give me the information to explain things to me. And basically I was just given, you know, I was supposed to parrot the company's bylines, and we would practice every single time that we got together for a meeting or any kind of gathering of representatives with management. We would do what they call toe-to-toes and knee-to-knees, where one line of reps would play the doctor and then another line would oppose them and play the representatives, and we would practice objections that we had heard in the field from doctors. And then we would all repeat the exact same verbiage, and often even having legal presence so that they would know whether or not we were saying it exactly the same way that everyone would. And we'd just go down the line and practice, and you'd move on to the next rep and they'd be the doctor, and you know, and you'd practice this every single time, so that by the time that we would leave those meetings, we would know any objection that came up from, you know, a doctor in the field, we would have a prepared answer for it, and it would come, you know, off as though we didn't practice it or anything, but this was, you know, just our solid base of information. And when I had been in the industry long enough then to start doing my own critically intelligent thinking, you know, and doing my own research, and okay, now I've had enough training because I've been with several large manufacturers. I see that it's not one company that does it this way. It's all the companies that do it this way. Then I started to recognize that I was just a marketing tool and that I was being used. And that angered me. That angered me, and when I got angry, then I got vocal. And as you've probably known from, you know, if you've researched me, I'm still a very vocal person about when I feel that, you know, people are being misrepresenting the truth, because my campaign is primarily about informed consent. I believe that adults have the right to put anything in their bodies that they so choose, as long as it doesn't harm themselves or others, you know. And I truly had that ideology when I left, and I still feel that way to a large degree. But when it comes to our children, I just felt like we had a moral responsibility to get the truth and to have this information be correct before we put our children on these drugs and before we advocated that other people put their children on these drugs. And so that's where I really, it's the mother in me, the mother hen in me, that just really, you know, got upset and decided to make this my mission.
Wow. A woman on fire. I mean, it is really true. I mean, you're extremely, I just had to set that up to really, for clarity, that, you know, pharmaceutical reps are represented, are portrayed as educators. But really, you're a marketing rep who sounds more like you're trained, now this is in my opinion, or allegedly, pick one of those words. It seems more like you're trained to be a Jason Bourne spy in terms of the ability to infiltrate work your way into the personality of, you know, like you, I think I've read or heard you talk about, you know, showing up at the doctor's office with a box of candy, so that kind of gets you through the receptionist, and then you get to the doctor, and then you build rapport with the doctor. So it's more about marketing and learning how to, you know, get into someone's, I don't know what that's called, space. And then because you're a trusted person or you're a liked person, then will pay attention to you because they like and trust you. And so when you say, here's something that's, you know, great and you should be using this for your elderly patients because we think this is the way to whatever, that they're doing it because they like you, not because they necessarily are hearing completely what you're saying. Am I reading that wrong?
That's not an unreasonable analogy at all, and it's actually it's quite accurate. So, and I personally, I mean, just to backtrack a little bit, when I was in college, as I said, my degree was in language, Spanish and Portuguese. I had a certification in Latin American studies and did some postgraduate work in journalism. And I dropped out of journalism when I found out that I wasn't allowed to report the truth in journalism, that the government could actually, you know, edit what I was going to say internationally because of you know, security issues. So I was like, okay, I'm not into this because I want to be able to report what I want to report, and so I'm not going to complete journalism. So that was exactly true. And as I said, I was a goody girl from the get-go. I mean, I was trained by the best of the best, and we had expense accounts. In all of the 15 years I was in pharma and for any of the companies that I worked for, I was never able in any given month to spend all of the money that was allocated to me to spend on my doctors. So, I mean, I tried everything. I did happy hours at night. I took food everywhere I went. I had pins and pads and gimmicks and gizmos, and somebody had a new baby, I bought him a year supply of diapers. Or I mean, I had outrageous amounts of money to spend, and I was encouraged to do that. So quite frankly, when I got out of the industry and went to sell vitamins and herbs and things like that, I was amazed at the information that I had to know in order to do that, because I didn't have an expense account where I could bribe anybody. So I really had to completely relearn what it was like to be a sales rep, you know, based on the merit of your products and on information only. And that was just a huge surprise for me, that that wasn't how everyone conducted business and sales.
You mean you can't just take them out to dinner and convince them that you're going to do this? And when I'm selling herbs for Gaia or for Nature's Way, like, oh, let's go out and have a big meal and talk about this. You don't have an expense.
No, exactly. And you know,
it's a shock.
Yeah, and you know, there were many. There were many occasions where even doctors who felt like, because of their integrity, they didn't want to be influenced by pharmaceutical reps, and so they were called no-see physicians, which meant that they didn't see pharmaceutical reps in their offices. In those on those occasions, I was able to get opinion leaders from the community, or I could find whoever it was if they had, you know, if they had a specialist that they, for example, they were a general practitioner and they had specialists that they referred their patients to, then I would get that person that they admired, invite them and their wives all out to a five-star restaurant and, you know, rent a private room. And even one time I even had someone, you know, come and deliver a singing waiter with a bottle of champagne in the office to remind them with, you know, engraved invitations and all this kind of stuff, just first class everything. And then I spend a couple of $1,000s to influence the doctor through a local opinion leader because I wasn't allowed to see those people. So there were methods of getting around and influencing people, and the more unique and my approaches were, the more accolades that I received from the company. And so I was never admonished for anything like that, except for maybe initially by some of my older peers, which were a little bit disgusted by the fact that, you know, I didn't have the knowledge base that I needed, but that I was so successful in sales and was blowing them out of the water just based on, you know, my ability to influence people.
I have a question, and it may be totally political. Where, this really should be a Richard question, where did it come about that pharmaceuticals and even the health field, where and how did money become so much more important than health?
Well, you know, I think you'd have to go back to the very beginning. And I believe that's a long-standing battle that has taken place between allopathic healing and chiropractic and homeopathy and, you know, everything else when the Rockefeller Foundation was first implemented. And I believe, honestly, from all of my experience in all of the companies that I worked for, that profit was the major motivation. They were concerned about their portfolio sales, about the dividends that stockholders were to receive, and their own personal gratification and personal, you know, ability to rise up the corporate ladder. I never really saw anyone that expressed, you know, that being their primary concern or their primary motivation for getting into the pharmaceutical industry. In fact, I'll share an experience with you. When I was first getting into the industry, I was in my final interview. You have to go through, you know, 3, 4, sometimes 5 interviews before you can actually get a job in pharma. And it was my final interview, and the regional manager turned to me and said, okay, so, you know, what exactly, why exactly do you want to come work in the, come out, I was working at, in the Medicaid program in Texas at that time, come out of the Medicaid program and work in the pharmaceutical industry. And I said quite honestly and quite naively that, you know, I just want to help people. I want to be able to help people. I want to make a difference in the world. And he laughed at me, literally, openly laughed at me, and turned around and he said, well, because he was turning around to his calculator at that point and was getting ready to tell me about the benefits package, and he said, well, young lady, he said, if altruism is what motivates you, perhaps you need to join the Peace Corps. But if money is what motivates you, let me tell you how you can retire from this job as a millionaire. And then he started calculating on his, you know, calculator and telling me what I would make in a few years and about my stock portfolio and my benefit plan and all of this. And, of course, I was 26 years old and my eyeballs rolled into the back of my head and cha-ching, I was sold. Because at 26, I mean, I never dreamed I would be able to step into that kind of a lucrative paying job and you know, do the things and travel and have the experiences that I had. So I'm very grateful for having been in the pharmaceutical industry because, you know, for a long time I felt very guilty and I had a lot of remorse and felt like, you know, that I had done something wrong. But actually it prepared me to be the Trojan horse that I was, and it has gifted me in many ways to see the truth about what's going on, and it probably saved my life, and I know it saved other people's lives.
Well, it gives you such an amazing, you know, inside story to have you, you know, flip I'll use the term flip to the other side, where you then went into looking at, you know, looking at the world of herbs and, you know, botanicals and homeopathy and, you know, all sorts of things. I'll interject here that the book, The Pharmacopoeia, which was one of it, which was the early reference for pharmacists, where they would actually compound pharmaceutical products, but they'd compound them out of herbs. And in the old days, back in the 80s, when I had an herb store, I'm a master herbalist, that about 70% of those compounds were derived from herbs. So, you know, it's funny. It's funny that you reverted back to the herbs, which are really, before they got, corrupted to being synthetics, when they were actually compounded as whole foods derived from herbs, they were different. And that so much of the world that is now the pharmaceutical industry had its foundation in deriving things from herbal compounds. Really is amazing that you went full, yeah, in a certain way you've gone full circle to, like, now you're back in the, you know, the world of herbs and the, you know, all that. I mean, it's really an amazing story.
Well, it's actually, I went more full circle than you realize, because my grandfather was a wildcrafter in the Appalachian Mountains, and he hunted ginseng and golden root and all of those kinds of things and sold them. And so as a child, I was receiving an education from him about what various herbs and things were. But when I went into the pharmaceutical industry, of course, I thought he was just an old hillbilly that didn't know anything, and I was just, you know, on top of the world. And so it was really a humbling experience to come full circle for me.
That's amazing.
Well, you know, that actually happened to me when I was in college. We had an epidemic of trench mouth in my dormitory because they weren't sanitizing the silverware properly. And everyone, you know, went to the local health clinic and got antibiotics, and they were all on antibiotics for a couple of weeks. And my grandfather came, and he said, "Oh, don't take that crap." He says, "Come on out with me. We'll go out to the woods." And he found some, what he called yeller root, but it was actually golden seal. And he dug it up, and we brought it back, and we made a little tea out of it on my hot plate. And, oh, my God, it was horrible tasting. And I remember drinking that and waking up the next day and being one big pimple all over my body. And I was just horrified. But it had actually detoxed and was flushing everything out through my skin. And I was over the trench mouth in 2 days, whereas all of the companions in my dormitory were still taking antibiotics for weeks, and then they got other problems as a consequence of the antibiotics. So, you know, I've actually done that firsthand.
Wow, that's an amazing, in everything that I've read or heard about you, that I didn't know about the grandfather part. That's slightly mind-blowing that you grew up with that in your life, and then you were, you know, you went into the pharmaceutical industry having come from that knowledge of, like, exactly that experience. Somebody goes out in the woods, somebody who's oftentimes perceived as not very intelligent, like many of these shamans. There was actually a pharmaceutical company started in the West Coast called Shaman Pharmaceuticals, and that was because what they did is they went to they went to the jungles. I'm not sure which jungles, but, you know, let's say Peru and they go into the jungles with a shaman who seemed perceived as not very smart, and yet knew all these amazing botanicals. And that's, they would go and follow these shamans into the jungles, and they would find the herbs that they were using that were having amazing results, and they would then bring that herb back into the United States and make a synthetic compound, thusly called shaman pharmaceuticals. So it's
right.
It's, you know, it's just amazing. Okay, so I want to jump to the arena of chapter 3 in your book, which I should mention the actual title of, since I don't think I did, which is Confessions of an RX Drug Pusher. And I'll put the link in the show notes of where you can get that. To Chapter 3, which is A Case Against Antidepressants. And the overall, you know, overuse of antidepressants, this is, again, that's your chapter. I'm ranting about it in the sense of just this stunning amount of antidepressants that are in use on, like, a daily basis on all age groups. It's just amazing. So please talk to us about, I know that's a passion project of, you know, antidepressants is how I would case it. So please.
Well, like I said previously, I had my own personal adverse reactions on antidepressants, and you know, I was given my own labels, and of course once I detoxified my body and I recognized side effect profiles because I had sold haloperidol, which is one of the older antipsychotic medications, and I was noticing that the side effects that I was having from antidepressants were some of the same side effects that I had been educated on from the antipsychotic class of drugs. And so I was like, whoa, you know, I'm having major side effects that shouldn't or aren't affiliated normally with this category of drugs. And so I did the same thing that many other people did. You know, I was switched from one drug to another drug and tried to, you know, stabilize. And finally, it wasn't until I completely stopped taking the drugs and I cold turkeyed off of the drugs, which I have to say, don't ever cold turkey off of any psychiatric drug. But, you know, particularly antidepressants are very dangerous because that's when a lot of the homicidal and suicidal ideation kicks in. When you start taking the drugs, sometimes there's the psychological effects of apathy and emotional numbing and that sort of thing. But after you either adjust the dose or you try to come off of the drugs, that's when the real danger kind of, you know, comes into play, because that's when people get violent. That's when people have, you know, severe side effects, like I said, such as the suicidal and homicidal ideation. And if you look into the school shootings and all of these mass shootings and that sort of thing, you will see that a number of these people, these perpetrators, were actually on antidepressants or were trying to withdraw from antidepressants, or as the mainstream media often says, they weren't taking their drugs. That's all the further that they generally go. They don't explain why they weren't taking their drugs, because they were actually, you know, becoming worse on the drugs than when before they started taking them. But I really have this mission about informing people about antidepressants, because there is no clinical data out there to support their use. If you look at the meta-analysis, especially the one that Dr. Irving Kirsch did, and he has an excellent book out that just came out recently called The Emperor's New Drugs. And what he actually does is goes through a meta-analysis of all of the antidepressant studies and clinical studies, and you see that no more than 10% of the patient population responds to antidepressants long term. They may get an initial, you know, benefit out of them, but as I like to explain to some people, well, you know, that happens with some drugs initially. If you talk to a person that's, you know, using a cocaine user, they will recount to you that when they first started using cocaine, that they felt like they were on top of the world. They had more mental clarity. They felt like they could, you know, they had more energy and all this and that. But then go back and talk to that same user 5-10 years down the road, and you see that now cocaine is the monkey on their back, that they can't function without it, that they're addicted to it, that they have decreased cognitive function, that their moods aren't stable. And that's exactly the same thing that happens with other psychiatric drugs. In fact, stimulant drugs have the same kind of biologic effect as does cocaine. So a lot of the ADHD drugs like methylphenidate and some of the antidepressants, which are also stimulant drugs, cause these same severe addiction problems and withdrawal side effects. So there is no clinical data that supports the long-term use of these drugs. Long-term, they cause a deterioration in almost everyone. And short-term, there's only a very small percentage, and it's usually the most severe populations of depressed people that get some initial benefit. And then beyond that, you know, initial maybe 4 to 6 weeks, which is what they use to evaluate people in most of the clinical studies and admit that, you know, information to the FDA, then the drugs start to cause a deterioration and outcomes are not positive. But of course, those aren't the outcomes that the pharmaceutical reps and the companies tout. It's always those initial positive outcomes that they want to talk about, and they also cherry pick the patient populations for these studies so that you don't have people that are likely to have severe side effects. They don't use, you know, women that are pregnant, which now they have pregnant women taking antidepressants, you know, as a deterrent. And so it's just, as a, you know, a logical human being, if you look at the body of information that's out there and you don't just buy into the pharmaceutical propaganda, I believe that 99% of the people who are prescribed these drugs would not choose to take them if they were well informed. And so that's the reason why I say my mission is an informed consent mission. I want people to get the truth and to be able to make their own judgment and decisions based on good information versus on propaganda and marketing.
And do you, man, there's so many directions that we can go. Do you feel that there are possible positive benefits from short-term use of antidepressants? If they were really under the guise of, we're going to do this for 2 weeks to break the cycle of the depression, or you know what I'm, the direction I'm moving toward, and it was something to break the pattern and then taper off that drug, not say like, you'll be on this for the rest of your life. But, you know, rather
again,
that kind of
control that's what the clinical data supports, is that if you use the drug short term for, you know, an intervention process, say someone is suicidal, I would never say, no, don't use anything. I mean, because if that person's life is endangered just based on mood, it's time to intervene in some way, shape, or form. And perhaps they don't have the ability to go inpatient somewhere or don't want to go inpatient somewhere, because that just puts you in the whole risk category of being drugged against your will. But, you know, I'm not going to say that all drugs are bad, but what I am saying is that the clinical data does not support that these drugs are efficacious for any long period of time. It is a short-term intervention for the most severe states of depression that actually show an effect. Otherwise, I know as a pharmaceutical rep and from my pharmaceutical training as well, that if you have a 10% population of people that get a response, 60% of that 10% is placebo effect and placebo effect alone. So there's really a minute population of people, and we're talking about millions and millions of Americans, and then, you know, all over the world, you're talking about, I don't know, maybe even billions of people that are taking these drugs, and many of them are taking them off-label for off-label indications where doctors are using them for, you know, all sorts of things, even menopausal symptoms. And I say to myself, this doesn't make sense, and it's definitely, in my mind, a criminal approach to make money.
I can't argue. I have no argument with any of that. I can't, you know, it really does blow my mind. I was, as I say, I was in a nursing facility, and this goes to a side question with you regarding the antipsychotic drug, that you got some advice from a supervisor about taking some kind of drug, but I don't remember what, into nursing homes, because that was a market nobody
had. Haloperidol.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's one of the major antipsychotics.
And it puts you kind of into a soporific or a stupor. Is that true, typically?
Absolutely. Well, they're like a chemical straitjacket, is what they are. So what I had experienced was that I was in the third quarter of the sales period, and I was in a territory that was a coastal, smaller town in Texas where I didn't have the vast number of psychiatrists in my particular sales territory as, say, some of my competitors and colleagues did in Dallas, Houston, and Austin, and larger cities like that. So I was lamenting to my district manager that I didn't think it was fair that my quota was so high because I didn't have the vast number of psychiatrists to appeal to write my drugs, and so therefore I was at a disadvantage. And so my district manager said, well, you know what I would do if it was me, and if you tell anybody I said this, I'll deny it. What I would do is I would go in to find out who all of your directors are, all the doctors that have, you know, directorship in your nursing homes. And he said, and blitz campaign your nursing homes. Go out and buy them lunches and take them goodies and talk to your nurses. And I even had nurses that were after we'd have lunch or something, they agreed to, when they put patients on the drugs, they would record the number of patients that were put on the drugs for me, or that they recommended to the doctor, and that I would reward them in some manner after that. And this was all, you know, this was all explained to me by my district manager on how to do this and, you know, what budget that I was allowed to utilize to do that. And so I hit the ground running and took his advice and blitz campaigned all of my nursing homes in order to get my sales quota up so that I could maximize my bonus. And people were more than happy to run with that information, but that's another story that I write about in my book, is that I saw the direct effects of that, because there was a woman who I call Ida Smith in my book, who was in her probably early 90s, and she was a little silver-haired, white-haired, you know, woman with, she always had this bright red lipstick, and her hair was always perfectly coiffed, and she was kind of the matron of the facility, where she was always running around barking orders and informing nurses that, you know, there's so-and-so has a bedpan that has to be changed, and you haven't changed the IV bag in such-and-such room. And she was kind of like the hall monitor, you know. And so I always was amused, because the nurses would be very put out by her behavior, and every time I was there, I would observe some sort of interaction between her and the staff. So after I had started blitzing these nursing homes and went back, I called on this particular facility that Ida Smith was in, and she wasn't anywhere to be found. So I asked the head nurse about it as I was getting ready to leave and said, you know, I missed Mrs. Smith today. Where is she? And she told me, oh, well, you know, she's kind of had a rough patch. Her friend died in such and such, I think, another room, and she has been sort of depressed and not sleeping well and whatever. And then she kind of perked up and said, but we had the doctor put her on Haldol, and so she's doing a whole lot better now. She's not combative anymore and doesn't argue with us, and you know, she's doing a lot better. And as I walked out of the facility, I saw an attendant pushing her wheelchair, which before it was a motorized wheelchair, so I would just see her running around the facility, you know, of her own accord, but she was being pushed by one of the attendants, and her head was bowed, she was drooling on her little nightgown, her hair was all a mess, and she didn't have on her signature red lipstick, and she just looked like a zombie. And I felt like somebody stuck a knife in my gut. It was like one of those moments where I realized that this was a direct result of my marketing and sales activity in this facility. And I thought to myself, well, this isn't the kind of patient that I was recommending Haldol for. But I went back and looked at my presentations, and I realized that that's all a matter of perception. This woman was combative and argumentative and problematic to these other staff workers, but, you know, she wasn't someone that I would have considered drugging with Haldol, but yet because of my activity, she had been drugged with Haldol. And I never went back to that facility after that because of my guilt feelings, so I really do not know what happened to that woman, but that haunted me for a long time, knowing that that was, you know, my responsibility, that I had been responsible for that.
Yeah. And I have two comments. One, that the facility I was in was about a 300-bed facility. And in between my surgeries, unfortunately for the staff, I was fully cognitive. I was like I am now in terms of talking. And so I would walk around the facility and I would see people. You know, every day I'd see the same people. And I walked a lot. And because partially for me, it processed off some of the anxiety of being in a, you know, weird location like that. And I would see people, and I had a similar experience. I had nothing to do with what she was on, but I'm certain she had a case of, you know, the ICD code, which is the code, I forget what that stands for, but, you know, the F9133, which is, I've heard you talk about this, the oppositional defiance disorder. There's an actual code for this, which we'll talk more about. But, you know, here was a woman.
I was diagnosed with that myself.
I bet. I think you probably have the T-shirt for that. And that's a great
yes,
thing. I think that really
should
be a
closet full of pharma T-shirts.
Yeah, exactly. That should be a T-shirt. We'll talk about that. But, you know, I would see this woman who was in a wheelchair, a push-around wheelchair, but she could get around, and we would sit outside under the, you know, covering, and we'd have conversations. And she was occasionally a little wonky, you know, she might wander off. But she was fully conversational when we were sitting and talking. Fully cognitive, fully like right there in a bad mood about being in this facility. And so we'd talk, you know, every couple of days when I'd see her, because some days she would have bad days where she'd have to stay in bed most of the day. But one day I see her in the hallway, and she's you described her condition, head slumped over, drooling.
Mm-hmm.
So the day before, she was fully cognitive, talking to her, you know, a little cranky, you know, about the facility, complaining about being there, being oppositional.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day I see her, and head is slumped over, and I can, you know, barely make communication with her. I would sit across from her occasionally, and I would catch her eye, and there was a ray of, like, I'm in here.
Right.
However, she was dosed to being compliant, and it was horrifying to me.
I call that the lights are on but nobody's home syndrome. And when I was calling on mental health facilities and psych, you know, ER wards and stuff like that, I literally would see patients once they were drugged prostrate, lying on the ground wherever they were, just passed out cold, because the drugs would hit them, and wherever they were, they would just go to sleep, you know?
Right.
So I believe that, you know, that's another thing that makes me very irate, and that is these drugs are used as a social control mechanism, not only for children, but for elderly people as well. I mean, it just makes it convenient and easy to warehouse people and to keep them quiet. And that's not what these drugs were designed to do. They were initially designed for people with severe psychosis and schizophrenia, and they were reserved for those mixed states, you know, that were very hard to treat, and now they've even got children on them. In fact, I predicted 5 years before it happened, I predicted that they would start moving the antipsychotic drugs into the depression diagnosis area, because the information was getting out there about the danger of antidepressants. But what I didn't anticipate was the absolute genius with which they did it, where they came up with the new diagnosis for treatment-resistant depression, and then you didn't get off of your antidepressant, which wasn't working. And by the way, they never admitted that it was the drug that wasn't working. It's you that isn't responding to the drug. It's always the patient's fault and not the fault of the drug. So now you had to take an antipsychotic like Abilify or Clozaril or one of the others, to Seroquel, in addition to your antidepressant, trying to just get relief from depression. And that was ingenious, because not only did they not lose the antidepressant market, but they gained additional market share in the antipsychotic market from that. So, you know, that's just the way, that's the way they do business, and add-on business is the most lucrative way that they can promote these drugs.
Wow. Oh, that was it. I had a side comment there about, I was at a lecture by, well, I was actually recording a lecture for somebody by Andrew Weil, who's an MD and has been outspoken in the field of, you know, alternative medicine. And,
yes, I'm familiar with him.
And he stated when he was talking about drugs, he said, you know, if you go through the first thing he said, I want to clarify the fact that there are no side effects. They're just effects. They're all effects. There is no, don't think that, you know, this term side effect is a thing, because it's not. It's a term used. They're all effects. These drugs have all these effects, and that's that. It's not like, oh, and over here there's this weird side thing that happens. It's not a side. It's a thing that happens with that drug. There's that. And I can't remember his stats. I wish I could. About when he was doing a lot of research, looking at, you use the term the placebo effect, that if you go back and look at research, it's really stunning when you get really down into the fine footnotes of how much result there is, how much similarity is in a trial of drug. If you look at the placebo, really do the research, how close oftentimes the placebo effect is to the what their drug companies are representing as the positive effect of the drug, how close that percentage is to the placebo effect.
Right. It only has to be statistically significant over the placebo. And again, they're not even comparing. That's the, you know, the gold standard clinical trial. They use the placebo, not another drug that's already on the market or an older drug that's been tried and proven. You know, it's always against the placebo because of that particular issue. And that is the big elephant in the room with any psychiatric drug with pharma, is that there are people, because we're talking about mental, emotional states, a lot of times the support that people get from the doctor and from other people while they're seeking treatment is what actually helps them improve, or just their own innate wisdom to heal, and the fact that they think they're taking something that's going to benefit them. And it's really whether or not they can overcome the, as you said, quote-unquote effects that they don't want of the drug to get the benefit. And many people now are finding that the effects that are negative far outweigh the positives. So that's the reason why there's that body of information out there, and just, I mean, group after group on Facebook and the internet and everywhere trying to sound the alarm and tell people how their lives have been destroyed by being on these drugs.
And now, because I see that we're getting close to our time, I'm going to move it a slightly different direction and say, so what would you like people to do, or is there an action that you would suggest people take? Do you see people? Do you have a practice? I'm putting air quotes around that, you know, an advice practice.
Yeah, no, I'm not a medical. I have to do my disclaimer. I don't have any kind of medical license or degree to treat people. But what I do teach is self-empowerment, and I do retreats in Costa Rica and bring people in that are trying to recover and trying to get their sense of self back, because I believe that this epidemic has been perpetrated by our socialization and our acculturation that we are supposed to hand our power over to authority figures. I mean, I can tell you it is a lot easier to lie to someone than it is to convince them that they're being lied to by a professional such as a doctor or you know, someone else that they admire. And quite frankly, I mean, I was the person educating a lot of these doctors in my area, so I realized if other people were getting their information from someone that didn't have any more scientific background than I did, who I'd only taken one science class in college, which was Rocks for Jocks, never had a pharmacology class, never had an anatomy class prior to entering pharma, never had any of that knowledge base from which I could build on when I first went in, then I knew that people were at risk because the providers themselves were not seeking out their own information. And I knew that they did not get any education on drugs after they left medical school that wasn't provided exclusively by pharma or funded by pharma. So I was seeing that there really was no fair, balanced information, even though that's what pharma talks about all day long until the cows come home, how they give fair, balanced information. That's a bunch of BS. It's all skewed towards the marketing and towards the bottom line and towards the profit margins and all of that. So, I mean, once I recognized that, like I said, I felt like I just really had to disclose this to people and let them be aware. I really, really felt when my niece committed suicide, she burned herself alive. She poured lantern oil over herself and literally burned herself alive. And it rocked my world to the degree that I would have gotten, you know, like Paul Revere on a horse and ridden through the streets screaming it at one point if people would just listen to me.
That had to be, you know, I mean, it's completely understandable.
It's been 10 years, and I can't even talk about it without still feeling the emotion come up because it was so horrific and so traumatic, and I just never, ever wanted any other person to have to experience that. So,
and it's,
yes,
it's,
that's my...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And
sorry.
No, I was just going to say, no, I mean, it's understandable because, I mean, that's a horrific event in an, you know... And it's in a. It was from a world of, you know, in the sense that you were in the pharmaceutical industry, and the result of what occurred with her was the result of pharmaceuticals, or a combination of, you know, her psychological state and pharmaceuticals that led to what she did. I mean, and that is life changing. I mean, it's stunning, and it's not surprising that you'd still have an emotion today because it's a tremendous, you know. impact. I don't like to use that word, but it really was impactful, and it changed your world. So it's completely understandable. Yeah.
So that was the impetus, really, of my mission was, you know, it was just knowing that people did not know this information. And so I'm still trying to sound the alarm. But now I'm trying to work on educating people about it's your personal responsibility. People have to take personal responsibility for their health. They can't hand their power over to authority figures and expect the doctor to make all of their decisions, the doctor to have all the knowledge, because the doctor can get it wrong, even though their intentions may be good. You know, the old adage, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. So, you know, it's up to you. It's up to each individual to take care of the temple, to take care of the body temple that houses the spirit, to seek, you know, to know that there's a mind-body spiritual connection and that you cannot disassociate these three things one from another, that healing has to be approached in all three manners, that you have to eat pure foods that are not genetically modified, that are not burdened with pesticides and herbicides, and you need to drink clean water that isn't fluoridated and full of contaminants and chlorine and all of this and that, and that you just have to be diligent about exercising your body. It's a machine. It needs to be moved. If you had a computer, for example, and you poured a Coca-Cola on the keyboard every day, how long would it work properly, you know? Well, that's the way that your body and your brain is, and you have to take responsibility for your own personal well-being and not seek out a doctor every time you feel, you know, a cough coming on or a fever or something. The body has an innate wisdom of its own, and I'm a proponent of chiropractic. I'm a proponent of acupuncture. I'm a proponent of very many alternative modalities because I see them, how they work and how they actually benefit people. And so I try to tell people, seek out anything and everything that is alternative prior to starting on some major drug, particularly if you're talking about a mental or emotional disorder where they're trying to treat you with psychiatric drugs, because that road is a road that leads to disability. And if you don't believe that, you can read Anatomy of an Epidemic by Robert Whitaker, which is an excellent analysis of how our disability rates have just skyrocketed since people started taking these drugs, namby-pamby. And that's what they are actually disabled over a long period of time, and they end up being unable to work, unable to attend school, unable to, be a benefit to society in any way, shape, or form. They're just there.
And where do people find out more about you and your workshops in Costa Rica?
I have two websites. Of course, GwenOlson.com is my major website where I have all of my interviews and research and information and articles I've written and all of that sort of thing. So that's a very good, and also resources for people that are trying to withdraw. I refer them to various practitioners and things of that nature. But I also have a website that I'm forming, they've been hacked, both of them, so I'm trying to rebuild them as we speak because they were wiped out a few months ago. But it's called The Mental Health Alchemist, or the mha.gwenolson.com. And both of those sites are where you can reach me and interact with me. And I do wellness consultations where I will talk to people one-on-one and let them pick my brain and give them information about what I know or what I've experienced. But again, I don't give medical advice. That's not something that I'm licensed to do, and therefore I don't breach that because I don't want to be put out of business. I want to be able to continue to use my voice in this manner and to be able to assist people in regaining and recovering their self-esteem and their ability to feel that, you know, they're in control of their lives and that they have the power and they have the ability to make their own decisions.
I will, for people that are only listening, I will put both of those websites in the show notes. For people that are listening, that's GwenOlson.com, and I'll put the other, the mha.gwenolson.com site in the show notes as well. I knew it was going to be a good interview, and we could go on for hours because there are so many categories. But it was really stupendous having you here, Gwen. It was really enjoyable. and incredibly informative. Yeah, I enjoyable always seems tricky when we're in this arena, but it was, you know, it was educational, and it's an amazing story. And I'm so glad that you, you know, got out and you're doing what you are today, because you have a great voice with intense passion, which is stupendous. Thank you.
Well, thank
so
you.
Much.
Thank you for
you
having
bet.
Me, and I thank your listeners. And I encourage them, please buy my book. It's very good information, and that's how I support myself now, because that's, you know, really one of the, those in speaking engagements are really the only ways that I have to support myself now. So please support me and buy my book. If you know anyone else who is on these drugs, encourage them to become informed and to do their own due diligence around it.
And the book title, once again, I'll put this in show notes, but for people listening only, is Confessions of an RX Drug Pusher by Gwen Olson. And it's a great read. Again, in quotes, I mean, it's not a party, but it's an amazingly great read. So thank you so much, Gwen. This has been fabulous. Well, we may
thank
have to have you,
Richard.
Back for more, because it's like you have so much great information. Thank you.
I'd be honored to come back.
Thank you very much. All right, everybody, have a great week, and we'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.